Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along as we begin the show by talking with you about climate change. In the studio with me, Mary Blanchard, the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. On his way, Daniel Vimont, who is a UW-Madison Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and Director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climate Research. He co-directs the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. So that's our topic to begin the show. As I said, Daniel's on his way. He'll be here soon. You can join in with your own questions and comments. Already a caller online, but you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Mary Blanchard, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those who aren't familiar with it, let's talk about the Wisconsin Energy Institute and what it's about.
Sure. So the Wisconsin Energy Institute is located at UW-Madison, and it's working to develop sustainable alternatives to meet our ever-growing need for power, fuels, and chemicals. We really focus on a couple of things. One is just generating the knowledge about energy systems and working to develop innovations that can help move us to more sustainable, resilient, and affordable energy systems. We really do this in three ways. One is to foster collaborative energy research. We have a number of public events to cultivate public understanding and educate energy future energy leaders. And we also develop stakeholder networks and share expertise to solve energy challenges and create economic opportunities.
So lots going on there. How is the Energy Institute itself involved with climate change?
You know, one of the things that we're really working on is how to enable an energy transition that can help slow the rate of climate change. So that's really developing the knowledge and the innovations that, when deployed, could reduce the rate of carbon emissions out in the world. A number of years ago, I saw a professor who talked about how in history, about 30,000 barrels of oil was generated underground and sequestered carbon. And we now use about 93 billion barrels of oil each day, million each day. So effectively...
Wait a minute, is that for us or the U.S.?
The world.
The world,
93 million barrels each day. So if you think about that, we're emitting about a million years worth of carbon sequestration each year in our energy use, and we really have to reduce that.
Wow. So that affects the research that goes on climate change then.
Certainly. I mean, one of the really interesting things about energy is how interconnected it is with so many other systems in our world. So we're connected to agriculture because we use energy to harvest our food. We're connected to the water network. And what's happening with climate change is really important with respect to energy, too, because of our need. Our need for energy is very important, right? We really depend on it for our quality of life. And people are becoming more and more concerned about the resiliency of energy, you know, now with climate change. So my husband has a cousin who lives in California who's had power shut off four different times this fall, you know, and that for days on end, you know. And so, you know, if there were a power outage, that really can affect over a number of days our ability to have fresh water, for example. You know, and the wastewater treatment systems require energy as well. So it's really important in terms of the mitigation and the adaptation that we really address our energy challenges.
Yeah, and you think about Wisconsin in January with a power outage.
Right.
That's not a good thing.
No, no. It would be a very challenging place to live if we didn't have energy.
Oh, man. You know, Karen in Madison has something that I think we could probably respond to. Karen, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for talking about this issue. It's a longstanding issue, and that's part of my I'm just kind of heartsick because this is, you know, we've gone from talking about people talking and fighting about needing more science on climate change and global warming and waters rising, and we've gone from that, and we've gone over the tipping point now that corporations are now saying, okay, how are we going to adjust to climate change? And in actuality, we could have been doing this from the time of Jimmy Carter. There's Jimmy Carter, there's Al Gore, there's just so many people who've had their hair on fire, and people didn't pay them attention. And like Greta Thunberg says, we need to act as if our house is on fire, because it is, and we only have 10 years. And, you know, as your speaker is saying, everything is connected. And like this whole idea of tar sands, shipping them cross country over aquifers, and then selling the oil, or what oil can be got out of it, to China, or, you know, there's just so many things. Or even the war in Iraq. It was a war about oil, and President Trump is protecting the oil in Syria. And, you know, it's all about oil. And anyway, we could have been doing something much sooner, and we don't have till 2050. We have another 10 years if we're lucky.
Mm. Well, Karen, I thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your thoughts on this. Karen's a little disheartened there. Mary, a comment on her, what she had to say.
No, I appreciate Karen's concern, and that it has been an item for discussion in the national conversation for a long time. And I think there are people who have been worried about the economic impacts if we were to make an energy transition more to renewable energy. But I think the good news is that energy costs in terms of renewable energy, solar and wind, are now the cheapest kinds of electricity out there. And so people are deploying those now, and that's going to really help. And I think people are also starting to realize that the costs of disaster recovery are really equaling or exceeding what the cost might be to do this transition. The federal government spent nearly $500 billion on disaster recovery since 2005. And last year alone, there were 14 separate billion-dollar climate and weather events that rang up $91 billion in total costs. So there's real costs to what's happening with the climate. And I think that that will help motivate the kinds of changes that we need to have in our energy systems.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe you can talk about some of the specific research that's going on at the Energy Institute, some of the programs that folks are working on that, you know, at least in we hope will have some impact.
Yeah, I think one of the main areas we have at UW-Madison is a pioneer in what's called microgrids, which is a small self-contained electric power grid with the capability to connect and disconnect seamlessly from the traditional grid. So it brings together energy sources and energy loads. So whether that's solar or other sources, it can disconnect when needed to help provide power. And this is becoming an incredible area of interest. This researcher has been working in this space for more than 20 years. And, you know, as we've had things like Hurricane Sandy hit New York City and Lower Manhattan was without power for 5 days, this researcher, whose name is Bob Lassiter, his technology was installed in an apartment building in Lower Manhattan, which was the only building that had power during those 5 days. And I've talked to people in New York who said everyone knew about it, right? You know, the one place where they had power. So this could be a real solution in places like California, in other places. The U.S. military is installing microgrids on its installations because it doesn't want there to lose power and be dependent on the grid. So that's in terms of providing resilience for the electric grid, a microgrid really might start to be a building block for a new type of grid that could also help enable more distributed generation happening at customer endpoints. So as more and more people people put solar on their houses. The grid wasn't really developed to do that. It was meant to have large centralized generation and send power out to the customers, not to have power coming back from the endpoints. But a microgrid might be a way to better enable that type of activity as well.
So that, and I know this wasn't your research or work, but the microgrid, let's take that one in New York. Was it a solar unit attached to the top of the building?
You know, actually, it was something called a coheat and power system, which was dependent on the natural gas grid. So it was using natural gas to power it, so generating power and heat, which can be a very efficient way to heat and power businesses. So that particular one wasn't dependent on renewable energy, but instead using natural gas. But there are microgrids that would utilize renewable energy as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I suppose a place like New York, solar can be, it probably is fine for the tallest buildings. But if you're next to the tallest building, that may not be so useful.
Right. Well, and this is the challenge, right? There's so much opportunity for more and more wind and solar development across our country. So we really need to integrate all of these. And that, I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, is interesting is that our utilities are really aiming, I appreciate our earlier caller's perspective on, you know, we really need to get things done in 10 years and not just wait till 2050. But our utilities are really focused on becoming carbon free in terms of their emissions. Many of them are aiming at 80% by 2050. MG&E has pledged to be 100% carbon free by 2050. And Dane County is part of its energy and climate change office has been developing a climate action plan to help get Dane County to be 100% carbon free. And so they've really looked at a lot of different areas to try to address that.
And when we talk about carbon free, what does that really mean? We've used no...
Right. That would mean that there's no carbon emissions in the process, or it's carbon neutral in the process of generating that energy. So, for example, in the biofuel space, the plants that are used to make biofuels uptake carbon in the process of growing, and that then when you emit carbon in the process of making and then using that fuel, it would be the same carbon that was pulled in by those plants when they were growing. So that would be considered to be carbon neutral. There are some kinds of plants that could grow that would be carbon sinks, like switchgrass, for example, that has very deep root structures it then brings more carbon in and anchors it in the soil. And so then it really becomes a more carbon negative process if you're using switchgrass to grow biofuels.
Talking right now with Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, waiting on Daniel Vimont, a UW-Madison Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, as we visit about the impact of climate change on Wisconsin, talking about some of the research that's going on in that area. And you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments as we move along here. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at climate change and some of the work going on at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. With us right now, Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Questions, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Dan in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. I was just wondering if your guest could comment if there's been any research or any developments within utilities themselves to think about transitioning from the way we think of them currently as being suppliers and essentially billers of power to more of a coordinating role if our grids do become more sort of networks of dispersed microgrids. I mean, it seems that utilities are going to have to sort of rethink the way that they conduct themselves and do their business. And I was just wondering if there's been any research or any utilities that are obviously sort of moving in that direction. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that essentially the utilities really are very focused on what the future of the utility space is, and that they are, in general, electricity demand is going down, and that they see these changes and then really customer demands for renewable energy. And so I think there is a very strong effort on the part of many, many utilities for what is that new utility business model and how they might address the changing demands in the marketplace to, you know, again, enable the solar generation and to happen at customer sites, and that they are looking and the need for resiliency. So I think that this is a very high topic of conversation among utilities, and I think that there will be a lot of advancement in this space. There's a lot of grid level renewable energy that's happening now, and I think they're really trying to figure out how to integrate microgrids into into their network, into their grids. And I think that it might happen in places like California first, to be quite honest. Just because of having, like just this fall, having so many different outages as PG&E tried to they didn't want their grid to start fires, you know, so they were turning off the grid to millions of people. And people really don't want to deal with that on a semi-regular basis. We're used to having 99.999% reliability with our electric grid. And it also would be terrible for our environment if individual customers all installed diesel generators in order to provide their electricity. So we really need to look for microgrid solutions to try to help meet their needs. And there are companies out there working in this space as well.
And Stephen Waukesha, I think, has something relating to that. So let's give Steve a chance to join in. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Hey, thanks, Mary, for commenting on microgrids. You know, what thought that came to my mind immediately, and I'm an older guy, is that years and years ago, we used to have mainframe computers, and you hooked up a dummy terminal, and the data was distributed from that mainframe computer. And it's the same analogy. Eventually, a really smart guy, just so happens to be a graduate of my high school class, developed the software to create a network. And now the network is, you know, no longer distributed, but everybody contributes to it. And so we had networked computers. And it's the same way with a grid system, a microgrid. And what makes me excited about that is the fact that Tesla has now come up with a battery. It's still a prototype that will go 1,000,000 miles, not on a single charge, but it will last 1,000,000 miles in that direction for longevity of the battery. So if we're able to set up, microgrids using very long-term durable batteries in bulk, I think that if people are able to install units like power packs in their garage and able to charge them up using solar panels, that an individual may be able to contribute to the grid on a small scale, but you multiply that times the number of people who would be able to do that, I think that has very exciting potential.
Hmm.
Instead of just charging up your car, you could be charging or putting capacity during the day into the grid, and your charge up your power wall, which is a big battery pack, to be able to draw on that during the night to possibly charge up your car. So it's using, storage technology in a new fashion, such as the microgrid, but also being able to charge up something like an electric car. And what makes me really, really excited about that was a show that was on 60 Minutes last week. I don't know if you happen to catch it or not, about nodules that are being mined will be mined very shortly on the ocean floor off the coast of Mexico. And these nodules sit 2 miles down. They're little rocks about the size of your hand that contain all of the minerals that you need, the rare earth minerals, to make the lithium-ion batteries. Nickel, magnesium, and I think iron was the composition of these minerals. And it's estimated there were trillions of dollars It's a very, very fascinating article. You can Google it on, just Google it on 60 Minutes and you can review that article yourself. But now the potential is there to have all of the necessary minerals to be able to make the lithium-ion batteries, which really, really kind of ties into why Elon Musk recently signed a contract to build a gigafactory in China. China is one of the countries that's on top of extracting these minerals to make the batteries they need.
Yeah, and the U.S. hasn't. I saw that 60 Minutes piece, and the U.S. has kind of stalled for political purposes, I guess, in going after the rights to be able to mine various sections of the sea that are where those minerals are found.
Yeah, you're right that China has been sort of the primary supplier of rare earth minerals that have been part of many of these types of products, and that I didn't see that particular 60 Minutes episode, but I have heard about the nodules that are down at the bottom of the sea and concerns about how to do that in a way that isn't damaging to the ocean, but the potential of harvesting them. To go back to your other part of how we can potentially use these resources, if many people were to have solar and power, you know, the Tesla branded Powerwall batteries in their homes as part of the grid, I think that is part of what they're really trying to figure out in terms of a new type of business model. Because if we were to tap your electric vehicle or to tap your home battery, you would want to be compensated for that, right? And that we would need to figure out how to measure and compensate you, because every time you're charging and discharging that battery, you know, there's a little bit of an impact on the lifespan of that battery. And so this integration is part of what, like, the U.S. Department of Energy is definitely looking at and exploring how, you know, especially with respect to electric vehicles, how those get integrated into the grid as we look to build more electric charging stations. And, you know, again, that resource of the battery itself. There are also challenges of how to really effectively do demand response, where we might be able to get especially large business customers to lower their demand at certain times so that the utilities don't have to turn on their peaker plants. So if we can have levelized energy, that can really help save money too. But there really is a ongoing effort to really address how, as we move towards more distributed generation, how to integrate that in a way that fairly compensates everyone.
And thanks a lot, Steve, for that comment. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Just to look at a couple of the emails and so forth. Jim in Cedarburg emailed. He wonders if direct current is more efficient for appliances, such as his furnace. And he wonders what a microgrid would actually look like.
So I actually can't say whether DC would be better for a furnace or not. I have heard of people talking about for long transmission lines, you know, DC is more efficient, and that perhaps as we have more and more wind built in windy places like North Dakota, that we should have more transmission lines that can help bring that. You know, that's a topic for discussion. Lots of people can, you know, have different perspectives on that. I'll just say that there is a effort being promoted by, like, rural electric co-ops and others saying that we really should electrify our houses. We should move towards electrification and away from natural gas for heating because the electric grid will get greener and greener over time. And that if I lock in my new furnace for 18 years, you know, if I buy a new furnace, and even if it's very efficient, it's not going to be as efficient as something like their new types of heat pumps that can work in cold environments that could be powered on electricity, and that grid will get greener and greener, you know, or whether we should have electric stoves, et cetera. So I think that that's a really interesting area. There are certain cities like Berkeley, California, has recently banned natural gas in certain kinds of multi-unit residential buildings, trying to move, again, towards more electrification with this idea that the grid is going to get greener and greener. In terms of what a microgrid can look like, you know, it really can be a wide variety of sources, whether it, and one of the interesting things about the what our professor developed is a kind of a plug-and-play system where you have the software in the products and they so whether it's a solar panel or the things that are using it, and it's where you can plug it in and it'll automatically adjust, and that so it could have solar, you could have a small wind turbine, you could have a generator there, you know, in case failures of the others because they are intermittent resources. The CHP system that I mentioned already, and that, but that this system will automatically balance so that it can keep operating. And as I mentioned before, you know, that this really is becoming something that's being more and more installed, especially places like hospitals that offer critical services. They don't want to lose power. I read a number of years ago when President Obama was still in office that the White House lost power and their backup generator didn't work. And so they were without power for 6 hours. And you can imagine that they're not letting that happen again. And that, you know, so I'm pretty sure that there's now a microgrid at the White House.
Well, you know, it makes sense just from I don't know if military is the right term, but of attacks on our system. If we have microgrids, it could be much less damaging overall if the main system is attacked.
That's true, right? And that, and I do think that there are more and more instances where we've had cold weather, like polar vortex, that almost took the grid in the Northeast, called the PJM grid, down a few years ago.
Yeah,
you know, that extreme weather events that are impacting the grid, and microgrids are really a way to address that.
We had Kenneth actually wondered where the funding for the Wisconsin Energy Institute comes from and how it interacts with the UW-Madison in general.
So we are part of UW-Madison, and that we are home to a very large research center called Great Lakes Bioenergy, which is a DOE-funded research center that's been in existence since 2007. It's a $25 million a year research center. We get our base funding from UW-Madison to help support that grant and support the other researchers in our building. We have about a dozen researchers located in our building, which is on the west side of UW-Madison's campus. We have another about 40 affiliates who work on research that we manage and work with our, what we call them, investigators, the people who are in our building. And then we have another about 100 energy-related researchers who are across campus, whether in the College of Engineering, the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and Letters in Science, who are doing energy-related research. And that's on a wide variety of topics, from nuclear engineering to new battery materials, to how plants can maybe uptake carbon more easily or also break down more easily to be utilized for fuels and chemicals. So it's really a wide variety of research that happens at UW.
It was really interesting, the number of departments. This is one of the good things, I think, about it. The last time we were doing a show in this area, we had a professor from the pharmacy who happened to be working, and you wonder, why in the heck would a pharmacy professor be working in this energy field?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. He does research on CRISPR, right? You know, and so the modification of different types of bacteria or enzymes, that's part of the work he does. And he's actually part of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. So even though he's in the School of Pharmacy, his research is related. And the same thing is true of people in agronomy, people who are who work on ecosystem services and how to be sustainable with respect to growing bioenergy, from entomology. So one of our researchers is from the Department of Entomology. So.
An insect person.
Yeah,
Yeah, there we go. Well, Bella, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling from Sturgeon Bay.
Hi. It's Stella, but that's fine.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. There are two things I'd like to share, if I may. The first is there is I would like to encourage people to think about and perhaps speak up anytime people are complaining that we can't do things for the environment, we can't do things to combat global climate change because it's going to cost too much, it's going to hurt the economy. There's a beautiful quote from Gaylord Nelson that says that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. Without an environment, don't have an economy.
Yeah.
That just sums it up perfectly.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to share is we live in Sturgeon Bay, and Sturgeon Bay has a nonprofit municipal utility. And we have solar panels on our garage roof and a grid intertie, which means that when we're generating electricity, we're running our meter backwards. And then when we're drawing from the grid, it's running forward and we're being charged. And we get what's called net metering. They subtract what we generate from what we use, and we get charged the difference. And one person called in about having battery storage, having solar panels hooked up to battery storage, and then he said something about either using it off the battery or feeding it into the grid. And I don't know whether the situation has changed since we installed our solar panels quite a number of years ago, but When we installed it, you could either have a grid intertie or you could have batteries, but you can't have both because of safety concerns if there is a power outage. They don't want their workers to be electrocuted, and I don't really understand what that is, but I mean why that is. But I do know that we can either charge batteries with our solar panels, or we can have the grid intertie.
Yeah.
So I think one thing to say is that if you have solar on your house, if there were to be a grid outage, unless you have a piece of equipment that can disconnect you from the grid, you're not going to be able to get the power from your solar, right? Because of the danger that you just mentioned to the people who are out there working to restore the grid. I don't know about this question of having the battery as being key to that potential danger to the line workers on the grid. I think that now people can have batteries and solar. I just recently went on a tour of the solar facility that's out in Middleton, Wisconsin. And in talking to one of the utility representatives who was there, you know, he was, saying that it might cost about twice as much as your solar if you were just to get solar,
yeah,
but that you could have them both. So I don't have more data than that. But I do know, and this, I think, is something that people need to understand, is that, again, if you have solar on your house, if the grid is out, you still won't have power, you know, and
yeah,
that seems wrong, right? But that,
yeah,
but that is the case, unless, again, you are able to disconnect from the grid.
Randy and Ripon will give you a chance. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Well, first off, I'm no electrical engineer, but I just wanted, you brought up long distance transfer at DC, and that's not feasible. Edison knew it, and Tesla's AC won out because of the transmission of long distance. And you can have a solar or wind powered system with a converter that converts it to AC, but the reason Edison was so adamant about DC is because you can't get electrocuted from it. This is a misconception that you, to have a cable to transfer DC even 20 miles, it had to be so phenomenally thick because you have voltage loss. You have voltage loss with AC, and that's why we have substations to build up the voltage for the city it's entering into. So, I mean, you really need to have an engineer on here, but just wanted to bring that up.
All right. Thanks
for sharing that. This is not my area of expertise, so I was just mentioning some things that I had heard people talk about in the past. So thank you.
Ted emailed that the Buboltz Nature Preserve in Appleton is a great example of a microgrid in action. And if people were interested in seeing it, I think the Buboltz Nature Preserve in Appleton, you know, of course you can show up there, you know, probably make an appointment, but show up there almost any time and have a chance to actually see it in action.
Yeah, I knew that they have a microgrid. I haven't had a chance to take a tour and to see all the pieces and what they've put together there, but that's great that there's something in Wisconsin that we can see. We also have a lab in our building that does microgrid research, so we'd be happy to give folks a tour if they wanted to come and see it. At the Wisconsin Energy Institute
and
building.
And that's part of your researching it? Or
right. It's just in the lab. So it's not the building itself is not on a microgrid, but that there is research and, students who are working in that space in our building.
Well, I tell you what, Mary, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
Love to have you back. Well, you'll be back in a couple of months probably. We'll do this all over again. I wanted to mention Dan Vimont wasn't able to make it. He's appearing in a Forward in Energy Forum at the Energy Institute. And maybe as we wind up here, you can talk about that forum.
Yeah, thank you very much. So it's December 4th at 4:30 p.m. in the Energy Institute building on campus, which is at 1552 University Avenue. Dan Vimont will be speaking along with Marcus Hawkins, who's the executive director of the organization of MISO States, which is bringing together all the companies who are part of states that are part of the Interconnect, the Mid-Continent Interconnect for Electricity, and also Brett Hoover, who's a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So they'll be talking about this issue of energy infrastructure, the resiliency of energy infrastructure, and climate overall.
So that's December 4th at the Wisconsin Energy Institute.
At 4:30 p.m.
Mary, thank you.
Thank you again.
Appreciate it very much. Mary Blanchard is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Great to have her with us, and they'll be back, and we'll talk again about energy. We zeroed in on climate change a bit, and we got into microgrids a lot, which I thought was very cool. And speaking of cool, John Martin is one of the coolest guys I know. He's one of our weather guys, and he's up next to talk climate and weather here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.